Okay, all right, all right, okay. This is your host, Kevin Pollock. Welcome you back to part two of my Mrs. Maisel pod, episode 21, part two with Katrina Link. Sorry again for the abrupt way we ended part one, but thank you for all your emails. Thank you for writing into my Mrs. Maisel pod at gmail.com, letting me know that it's okay, and your comment on social medias. Comments have been much appreciated. I will read one of your emails at the end of this episode, there, 21 part two. But how have you been? Did you have a good week? What transpired for you from last time you listened to an episode? Maybe you listened to that episode an hour ago. Far be it for me to presume like an idiot. Part two, we pick up where we left off as Katrina Lenk, Tony Award winner, and I are breaking down the season one opener. Nope. Episode one of season three. Season three, episode one, season three opener. That's it. Yeah, it was a blast talking to her, as you could tell from part one, I'm sure. Little less interrupting with my own stories, hopefully. In part two, I enjoyed a few tangents there in part one, but thank you for your patience and indulgence. Season three opener with Katrina Lenk continues here in part two. Please enjoy. Okay, so Mitch goes on and she kills. They love her. Her stand-up act once again seems to be talking about what's happening right now. And yet these are jokes a comedian could have written knowing they were going to perform for 980 soldiers. Like, you're so brave. I don't know how you wear the same thing every day. You know, that's sort of, I could never wear the same thing every day. That sort of also is in just in step with a great, carefully written act for, and but just delivered by the one of a kind Rachel Brosnahan, who will be the first to tell you, I don't know how well you know Rachel, she is not funny. I'm quoting her. She gets funny, she understands funny, she can deliver funny like a genius. She isn't a funny thinking person. You know how you get around a comedian or natural born ham comedically who just needs, there's no off switch, as I said. And Rachel, speaking more to her absolute expertise at dramatic acting, she's able to be so present in these monologues when her character is doing stand-up that you would think this has to be one of the funniest people who's ever lived. And she'll be the first to tell you, not at all. No. I mean, she's not a dour person in any way, shape, or form. She's just not a natural born comedic ham the way funny people are, you know? It's just kind of extraordinary. You sound a little,
it's kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Surprised, and I love that because it does speak more to just how genius she is. And I'm not, I really am saying she'll be the first to tell you because I've heard her say it so many times. When people compliment her and we've done a couple of live performances together. And the first one happened because my agent called and said, there's this big function and they tried to hire Rachel to do stand up for this big fundraiser for a lot of money, but she's refusing to do it because she's not funny. She's not just not a stand up. She wouldn't know the first thing. So anyways, Kevin, they reached out to us to hire you to open up for her, actually do stand up. And then the two of you will do a little sit down Q&A where you can continue to be the funny one, but you can pose questions at her that will allow her to be, you know, her charming self, which is pretty easy.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious. And to hear her tell the story of how much fun it was for her to watch me do stand-up and then sit down and just talk, the two of us, like we would on the set, waiting for the shot to be set up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was, it's sort of this running joke between us that I had to be hired so that she could perform at a function when they just wanted her to perform. It's almost like, why do we have to add him? You know, sort of thing. Well, it's because you'll see. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it was great. I'm sure you had everybody in stitches.
Well, I don't have a choice. I've been doing it too long. Yeah, it wasn't by chance that I ended up getting this call. They were just so relieved that someone else in the cast of the show, you know, this function is fundraising. They're selling all these very expensive tickets based on, because the audience is Jews who very much love The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Anywho. Yeah, so let's get someone from the cast. Oh, there is an actual comedian on the show? Okay, great. Yeah, let's get him. Yeah. So yeah, she really does great performing. And then she introduces Shy, which was part of her function at this big USO show. And he takes the stage. And Leroy just...
Oh, so good.
Yeah, an angel from heaven.
And you really, I mean, I forget that it's not now. Like he's capturing that style of that era so beautifully and like effortlessly that assume he's Shy Baldwin from the, I mean, I guess that's because I turn into a baby when I watch this show, but it's so good.
I love that analogy.
Really captures that whole
era. I love
that
analogy you've come up with. yeah, and he's got these three singers, Martha, Dee Dee, and Dawn, that for a little while were singing on stage themselves, and they're exceptional. I don't want to leave them out of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Truly, truly, truly great. Let's see. Then we're off to the Maisel and Roth office where Shirley, Ethan, Joel, and Moish. Shirley's gushing to little Ethan about their new home in Forest Hills, and Moish announces it's got a tree. Man's not a man until he's got a tree. Yikes. And then next, Moish tells Joel that his button man is moving out finally, and that this may be the perfect location for Joel's new club. The introduction to Joel's Brave New World.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, in season one, of course, the Joel character is the villain. In season two, they do a pretty great job at making him at least appear as a man who wants to do better.
Yeah.
And we start rooting for him. And then this Dr. Benjamin is introduced. And now it's are you in the Benjamin camp or the Joel camp? And then it ends with... Season two ends with Midge getting this opportunity to go on the road with Shia Baldwin right at the same time that she's talking marriage to Dr. Benjamin, and in an instant leaves him behind and goes to Joel and says, I've just changed my life forever. I'm going on the road. And oh, by the way, I just want to be with someone who loves me. That's how season two ends, right? And that's why they're in bed at the beginning of season three. Mm-hmm. So we're invested in what is the continuation of Joel's life as well. And so from a writer's standpoint, I'm always sort of stepping back and trying to delve in. The idea that he would then go off and start his own club, which is sort of established at the end of season two, that's what he wants to do when he and Archie are hitting baseballs out in the open field, drinking beers. And it ends with him saying, you know, I think I'm going to open a club. And so now here we are, his father may have found a venue. And his first reaction is, I don't want any part of your schemes, Dad. I do like that.
Yeah.
Back to the Hangar show. Shy is singing A Night in Berkeley Square. Place goes bananas. Yeah, there I met the singer who sings these actual songs for the show while Leroy geniusly lip syncs. Yeah, let's burst that little bubble. That's how good.
Well, that's incredible too.
Good in a different way. Leroy actually is than you might have thought.
That is no small
feat. I'm going to put that singer's name in the wraparound because I don't have it in front of me because I didn't know I was going to say this. Damn it. But yeah. Because I feel like I want to point out just how genius Leroy is.
Yeah.
At this. And so then afterwards off stage, Susie meets Shai for the first time and is very nervous around him. The way she was very nervous around Lenny earlier in the show, she gets around other extraordinarily great made talents and she really becomes nervous.
It really
is adorable. And it's a side of this character, Susie, we almost never see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we meet what is introduced as Shai's manager, Lou. A wonderful older Jew who, and I don't know, it just suddenly makes sense. Oh, right, of course, we got to meet the Jew manager. We'll find out more about that later. Maislin Roth office again. Joel takes a call from Midge, who needs to tell him, but also apologizes about sneaking out the other night after they, she struggles. She's struggling with this. How she noticed that he didn't call. This part of their relationship, and again, the writing is just so woman and man, on again, off again, but also the same way you'd be speaking if you were newly dating, right?
Yeah. That whole dishwasher argument they get into is so good.
All right.
She tries to do like an analogy, compares something to like if a dishwasher repairman came to your house, he would call to check in that the dishwasher's okay. And then they go on this whole argument about whether or not that would actually happen. And they start arguing about this thing that has nothing to do with what they're talking about, but then it does. It's so
right.
Good.
That relationship stuff, you forget just how good they are at writing. Yeah.
So good. Mm-hmm.
And also Joel's stance of listening to her say the dishwasher repairman would call the next day and see how things are going. And Joel's position is, no, he wouldn't.
They're both so invested in these
details of the analogy that's not real.
Yeah.
Yeah. So passionate. This argument would speak.
And I love, too, that, like, what you were saying earlier, that it's kind of like her, seems like Midge is struggling with being the Midge that's following her dream now and the Midge that had the dream earlier of the being the perfect housewife. And it's just kind of coming up, it's like facing that in that phone call in a way too.
So good.
Yep.
They all sing the final, the show's finale, White Christmas. And we really see why Midge was a little apprehensive.
She really doesn't know it.
Have you been in a group sing situation where you didn't know the? Yeah.
Yes. I won't say when and where.
Yeah.
But yes, you really try to look like you're singing those words.
I'll bust myself. Mm-hmm. So every year, there is this great fundraiser weekend in Kansas City for Children's Mercy Hospital because Paul Rudd, Rob Riggle, Jason Sudeikis, Dave Koechner, and Eric Stonestreet, all five are from Kansas City. And they bring out 30 celebrities or so, and there are all these various events through the weekend, and we raise millions of dollars for Children's Mercy Hospital, where no families have to pay for cancer or leukemia treatment for their children. And it's kind of amazing. But one of the functions we go to is we play a softball game on the actual Kansas City Royals field for a couple of innings before they play, the Royals play a real game. So then we stick around and we watch the real game from our little private area at the ballpark. And then there's the seventh inning stretch where they sing Take Me Out to the Ballpark. Now I'm a casual baseball fan at best, but 30 of us go out on the field to sing this song. And maybe six of us are holding microphones, but we are passionately, loudly singing. Well, I say we, because I mean everyone but me. I am mouthing what I think the words might
be. I mean, after Take Me Out to the Ball Game, Take Me Out to the Crowd.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. Yeah, man, they come back.
Root. Home team.
You're reenacting my performance every year in this moment. And it's
every year you have time.
Well,
to
it's
learn
on need to care basis. But we look next to me and I'm always entertained by whoever is standing next to me because we run out differently every year and it's always someone different. And they just look over at some point in utter disbelief. How do you not know this? And why are you so loud for someone who doesn't know what they're singing? Because I do hit those words that you just hit very, very loudly. And the rest I'm lip sync. Yep. So they're performing White Christmas, and it's hilarious that she doesn't know. And then she's off the stage. She's asked to sign a few autographs from soldiers. And then the fateful photo in the Jeep.
Yes.
And it's all done so innocently. She jumps into the Jeep with a couple of soldiers, and they're gathering around for the photo. And it's the house photographer who I mentioned earlier. We're talking about him again, as I threatened. And he's going to take two shots, thankfully. The first one, though, a gust of wind comes up, and as does her skirt. And we see a 1959 version of ladies' underwear. And then that second photo is taken. And unfortunately, that first one's going to make the rounds.
I feel like,
Sergeant Burns reappears and lets Midge and Susie know that it's expected and appreciated that Midge attend the dance with the soldiers later. That seems like a very awkward situation. But Midge proves to be a trooper, pun intended, and just needs to go home and change outfits, which again is just so perfect. Also perfect to figure out how, in the writer's room, how do we get Midge back home for this next scene? That is the knockdown drag out between Abe and Rose.
So good.
Yes. Now, before we get to that, I do want to point out that there is a phone call Susie takes from Sophie Lennon.
Oh, no. This is
in
so
the
good,
Jane
too.
Lynch performance in that tiny studio because Susie made Sophie go below 14th Street. And it's so early in their relationship Sophie representing her. Susie representing Sophie, that Sophie is laying some groundwork and some rules for their future together. And then Brian Tarantino standing there in the fur. And even when he starts to answer a question, she says, never
speak again.
Right? And she says it so matter-of-factly. And of course, he reacts the same way we want him to, which is to shut down. He's not going to speak again until he says it's cold.
And then she agrees with him.
It is cold in here. Yeah.
Too much. I can't take her.
Another clinic put on by Jane Lynch in comedy acting. And then we're off to the Weissman apartment for such, as a writer, one of the things I will tell you and insist, and all writers, I think, will agree, exposition is the villain in the story, in the effort. So how do I seem, make it non-present, right? How do my actors catch up the audience with information they need without it seeming? And for, as an actress, do you, how do you face what you know is exposition? Do you make certain decisions
or you got it, like, why am I restating this information that I already know to this other person? Like, you know, why am I saying it? What am I trying to accomplish by saying these things? Sometimes it's harder than others, but yeah, these writers do such an incredible job of just, it feels so, sounds like a cliche word, but organic to the scene. It's about like what's happening in the scene and their relationship. Then you just, you hang on, you're just like on for the ride, and that they're going to drag, they're going to pull you, and you just have to go with them.
Also make it so surprising to one of the characters that we get to instantly live vicariously through poor Abe, who's being instructed by, by suddenly powerful Rose saying, if not for my trust fund, we have nothing.
Oh yeah.
Who do you think pays Zelda? I do. I write her the $30 check. And then I give her the other 30. And this is just brain breaking for Abe. All of it.
And oh my God. Their relationship is too good. And especially, she's sort of changed since they've gotten back from their Paris trip.
Oh, yeah.
She's sort of just very subtly become this, she's kind of standing in her own power, so to speak, or something like that. She feels elevated.
Well, there's
in
a journey.
That she's aware. Yeah. So she's now this kind of new Rose, and he's also this new Abe, but they're, and it's just so fun to watch them navigate this in their relationship.
We talked a little bit about on the podcast over time that while seeking her own independence, Midge has inadvertently forced her parents to also seek their independence in their own ways that also empowers them.
Mm-hmm.
And the struggle becomes the necessary and eventful part of their path. It's kind of delicious. Again, this big overview stuff, stepping back. But in the moment, these two great actors are killing this scene and making it, again, the snappy, the timing, the pacing, the banter. You're not sure who's more delicious in the scene because they both are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Mary Nicole.
And then Abe's tantrum. When did I become?
Why do I have all these rooms?
That I need a Zelda. That I need all these rooms, that I need, that we need, that our daughter needs this room with all these dresses.
Mm-hmm. And that I have two sweaters.
Who wears two sweaters? It's so good that it's talked about later. Someone throws it in his, the cop.
The cop?
When he goes to see Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
Although I think Lenny might even be the one who says it. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
You're going to take this from a guy who's wearing two sweaters? Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
We'll get to that. Delicious, delicious, delicious scene. So, we need Midge to come back. And she comes back and finds a couple dresses on the floor. It's why she came back, to get a new outfit. And then she has this incredible sort of breakdown and a bit of a come to Jesus to them. About how dare you to suggest I've ruined your lives, or, you know, it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah. She totally speaks back to them and like calling them out for their,
she becomes the parent,
I guess, judgment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he listens, which is the sweetest thing. He listens and then actually does something about it.
They write to every character's intelligence. That's the other thing that needs to be noted. We don't have a dumb fall guy. And every show does. Because it's helpful when writing many characters. It's incredibly helpful to have a dumb fall guy. And so you should know, listener, hard to write to everyone's intelligence while letting them act the fool, which is what Abe goes through in this scene. And then I'm so glad you pointed out he actually listens to her. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the New Button Club, Joel, Archie, and Asian Gambler. As Joel and Archie are enjoying Joel's new club, Archie aptly names the Button Club in that moment. And then a crazed, angry man flees through a door near the back of the stage, yelling what we can only assume are obscenities in his spoken language. Joel and Archie naturally need to know more about this mystery door that the yelling man came through. And we cut to the what's beyond the mystery door as they descend some stairs. Even the tiling, the ceiling of this dark, smoky gambling den is perfect. As Joel and Archie and assorted gamblers are seen. Also, I love the noise, right?
Yes.
And how it instantly stops in unison when enough of them notice the two, these fellas do not fit, standing on the stairs. And then the choice, you know, what do you do with this stand-up? Where does the scene go next? Well, the two Caucasians slowly step back up the stairs. There's no conversation. It's just so great. And then sure enough, they're right back to their gambling. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They don't ask questions either. Which is what happens in the next scene when Stephanie, oh, she's so wonderful as May.
Stephanie Hsu.
So great. Joel and Archie are wrapping their brains around what they just saw, a young woman. Seemingly Chinese, certainly, but speaking the king's as if she came up through possibly both the finest of culture and education as well as the mean streets. She is a pistol. This is one savvy person and needs Joel to stand down with all the questions. And it beautifully ends with, leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. But man, oh man, is she more mysterious and interesting and compelling than that gambling den, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All that rapid fire dialogue in there too is so good. She handles it so well. Like, just off the cuff, as if it's all just
it just comes
tumbling out.
Who thinks and speaks this quickly? And then we go to the nightclub. At the front door, Abe enters. Is this where I see Lenny Bruce, or something to that effect? And the doorman explains the 2-drink minimum and so on. And Abe takes his seat. Lenny's introduced. He is loved. And he gets, you know, great laughs while ripping apart the bourgeois ideals of decency in our puritanical and hypocritical society, as only he can. And Abe, they keep cutting to Abe and listening intently, not smiling or laughing or enjoying himself, as one might at a comedy club, but taking it in as a Columbia professor almost, right?
Yeah.
Until two cops show up and we know what's coming, and so does Lenny. Abe, however, will not stand for this, though he will literally stand up and make it clear that he's not in favor of what's happening. We have the, this is a man wearing 2 sweaters comment. And then he's arrested along with Lenny. And in this great jump cut, it's a picture of Abe sitting in a New York City precinct lockup cell. You know, you just want, wait, what? How, you know, we're he's not saying anything, but we are inside his thoughts. And it's just what his face tells us. How did this happen? Was that a cat I just saw pass behind you, possibly?
Oh, probably. There's two that live here, so there are, it's possible.
Two here as well.
Oh,
yeah. There's Andy and Halston. We lost Edie, but you see the connection, I think, hopefully. It's the Andy Warhol universe. Mm-hmm. First was Edie, named after Edie Sedgwick, and then Andy. And then this new one is Halston. And she's 100% fluff. Not terribly bright, but we'll hope she'll grow into that with age.
I think she will. Sometimes they're slow bloomers.
Uh-huh.
Late bloomers, I mean.
Halston.
Yeah.
Halston. See if I can't get a cameo from the tuxedoed.
Oh.
Also makes sense that Halston would be overdressed for every occasion.
Oh, yeah.
So in the precinct in the lockup, Abe, we see that someone's lying in the cell behind him, and sure enough, it's Lenny. It's so great that he's lying comfortably, instantly establishing.
Yeah.
This is what happens, man. This is
He's been there before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty. I couldn't help myself but to remember, because I'm basically the sun and the rest of you are mere planets revolving around me. But in The Usual Suspects, there's a lockup scene, and later in the script it says that Kaiser Soze being interviewed. Well, it's verbal Kent, but he says, you can always tell the guilty party because he's the one that's sleeping in a lockup, not so much in the lineup, but in a lockup. He's sleeping because he knows he's been caught. And the alert people are the ones who are trying to figure out, why am I here? I hope I don't get found guilty of something I didn't do. And later we find out in that movie, my character was guilty of what these people had been arrested for. And so I chose to lie down in that scene. So it's always forever in my mind when I'm watching everything else that takes place in a lockup situation, who's lying down, who's, you know.
Yeah, sure enough, interesting.
Here's Lenny incredibly comfortable with the fact that he has been found guilty. In his case, an absolute sham of a law, if there is one, but he's not sweating it. Abe, on the other hand, is not comfortable. How great is Luke Kirby? Should we take a moment?
I mean, similarly to how I feel when watching Leroy McLean, it feels like this person is from this. This is this person from this era.
Yeah.
What?
Well, don't
just
don't
incredible.
Take it too personally, but their Amy and Dan's genius in writing carries over to their genius in casting. They do have an extraordinary, near unparalleled knack over these five seasons to cast just gems every which way.
I was wondering if when we hear Lenny Bruce's stand-up, is it based on actual stand-up that he did?
At times it's verbatim. At the end of season two, he does this appearance on Steve Allen where he sings All Alone. And there's a YouTube video of that exact appearance that it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch the YouTube reel and then the scene that Luke does, because it's kind of verbatim. They're not all like that, but many of them are from his actual act. I believe showing the child the stag film. Just love that term. It's so dated. I believe that is definitely from his act. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
he's so good. My.
Yes. Yeah, and mesmerizing and compelling. You're not watching someone do an impersonation in any way, shape, or
form. No. Yeah.
Oh, Luke Kirby, one of the great Canadian Jews. Yeah, he approved. He approved the following Canadian joke of mine. I don't know if you've shot or worked a bunch in Canada, know much about the Canadian people. They are overly polite and wonderfully nice. Yeah,
that I do.
So the joke is, how does a Canadian answer the phone? Sorry, hello.
Is it true?
Do they actually apologize when they answer the phone? Yep. Yeah. The one I had heard was how you get 1,500 Canadians out of the swimming pool. You say, please get out. Please get out of the pool. Yep. Incredibly polite, and they'll figure it out. I do love that the end of the Abe and Lenny and lockup that Abe says to Lenny that the flowers are really nice. And we know what that means, and Lenny has no clue. That's a great little thing to give Abe. You know? Ugh.
Yeah. He's got soul. He does. I feel like he's just confused as to where to put it.
There you go. Back at the army barracks, Susie and soldiers. Susie's playing cards with a few soldiers in one of their bunks. We know how that's going to go. And we soon learn that she's just killing time until Midge gets back with her new outfit for the dance. And we go to the dance where we see Sergeant Burns again and the soldiers and the ladies. And Midge and Susie size up the situation. Susie takes a swig from their shared flask and begins to tell Midge she's going to manage Sophie Lennon. And this scene, choreographed and such angst for Susie and such anger and resentment and confusion for Midge, all in the midst of this dancing that doesn't stop in and around them. Even all the way to the very end of it, when Midge is so angry and gets sucked up into a conga line and dances the conga angrily.
She does.
So funny.
Yeah. So funny.
Love, love, love it.
And there's probably some tie-in between the dancing, because the theme, like the show starts with all that dancing. The unison dancing, and then the end, it's more of like a chaotic sort of
socialized,
some social dancing. Then there's some thematic tie in there, I think.
The aforementioned wraparound. It's a lovely trick they've played with us, haven't they? But there is one more scene, and it's just the New York City precinct lockup. But yeah, I agree with you. The choreography is so delicious that we do get a sense of, oh, I see what you're doing here. Yeah. You've brought it somehow back around to men in uniform and women dancing. And great choreography, but also woven in this angry argument and great, great, great performances from Alex and Rachel once again, standing their ground, and how vulnerable Susie has to be, but also stand her ground. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess in the beginning, it's all on the stage. The dancing's all on the stage and they're observing it in a way. And then at the end, they're now inside that world.
Yeah, and imagine the amount of rehearsal, because they have to portray this argument that is oblivious to all the dancing, even though Midge kept getting swept up in it. It's never her idea. Hey, I want to dance.
Right.
She'd much rather continue the intense argument. And when to bring her back in. Watch that one a few times, folks. But our final scene is a New York City precinct lockup. Abe descends the stairs to discover that Rose bailed him out. He's not ready to leave just yet, though, and we quickly see why. Lenny descends the same stairs and discovers that it was Abe that bailed him out. This world is getting smaller while the Maisel universe is expanding. And it's also very brilliantly written, performed, lit, captured, sound recorded, costumed, production designed, choreographed, post-produced, and scored. Yep, folks, soup to nuts or ovum. Soup to ovum. This show is spectacular. Oh. Sorry. Yeah,
it took
that was
me a second.
Unnecessary wordplay.
That's good.
But it seemed inappropriate in this woman eccentric story and serving. Every single aspect and department represented in yet another episode where so much is going on. And again, there's, as we talked at the beginning, there's that challenge. We're going to start a new season. We need to remind everyone in episode one, we're not fucking around.
Right. Right. Yeah. And like, we're in for the ride. Like, I wanted to just keep, I mean, I watched them all. And then when I rewatched this one, I was like, oh no, I want to keep watching. I need to know. I'm in. Yeah. I'm in again. I love that about it. I'm invested. I'm in. I need to know what happens. I care about these people.
Yes. Well, I can't thank you enough. I've certainly taken up
more
than enough time than I asked for or deserved. Unless there's anything at all you would like to add to the conversation.
No, I don't. Thank you for inviting me to do this. I hope I didn't mess it up.
Impossible. Impossible. Yeah. And I hope they don't keep us apart next time we're working on the same project.
Yes,
I'm such a fan. And
great job,
as always. And for my needs, perfect addition today to the proceedings.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Good.
Yes, there you go. That was part two with my conversation with Katrina Lenk. Just delightful. I adore her. And I hope you enjoyed our breaking down of the season three opener into two parts. Thank you again for your patience for that. And thank you for all your comments and emails to my Mrs. Maisel Pod at gmail.com. As threatened, here is one of your emails. You know, as I go through them now, I realize I haven't made enough notes and kept a proper file as to which email I've answered. I started to keep that file, but then too many times I was pressured with time being out of it and suddenly had to look up an email real quick to answer while I was recording mine. This might be one of them. I don't know. I really don't know. But we're going to press on. Write to me at my Mrs. Maisel Pod at gmail.com and let me know if I already answered this one. From Amy. Hello, Amy writes. Really enjoying the pod. I listen on a little app called Double Pod, as I have an Android and I hate the ridiculous ads on Spotify. I'm a longtime Gigi fan and anything A&D are up to. So a question that came to mind for me is, what is it like being directed by Amy versus Dan? Thank you for sharing and putting this together, Amy. Well, there was no last name included. I'm going to assume this was not an email from Amy Sherman Palladino trying to catch me. Pretty safe assumption. Amy versus Dan. What's it like being directed? So I feel like this might have been answered within the context of a few conversations, but just in case. And again, I apologize if I already brought up this email and answered it properly. I would say
that, and the other actors have commented about this too, getting a laugh or whatnot from Dan was always tougher than Amy. Amy was not an easy laugh by any means, but a little bit easier than Dan. And you know, we're children, the artists playing in the playpen, the playground, all the playpens on every set. I get it's more like a playpen than anything. So we're trying to get mommy and daddy to like us and like what we do. Look what I can do, right? That's somewhere buried deep in all the artists. So if they are mother and father, although in Amy's case, she's everything, you know. The word on Dan is that he's a little close-vested? What's the vest term? Write to me at my Mrs. Maisel Pod at gmail.com and let me know. Tight-vested. Keeps his thoughts inside, doesn't share a lot. So that would probably be the biggest difference. Between the two of them, if there's any quelling to be done, it's from Amy. But there is a sense, absolutely, that we are loved by both. While we're working with each, there is a sense of absolute, genuine love and respect. So in that regard, they're not different at all. In terms of their styles, I would say that Amy, as you've heard, is pretty much, that was great, let's try it again. Until she gets it. And maybe Dan's similar, but also, I tell you what, let's try this, he might say on occasion. Where I almost never heard that from Amy. I didn't hear much from Dan, but again, I'm reaching for a difference between them. The personalities are quite different, but they've been together so long, right, that the creative process ends up being pretty similar. But overall, and especially in their style and the way they set up shots, and there's a rhythm and a similarity between them for sure. And then the actual doing of it. They also share the say less to the actors. I sensed a little more playfulness from Amy between herself and the David Mullen or some of the crew, but they both get along with the crew so well in their own way, so exceptionally well. So there you go. There's my long-winded way of saying very little. But thank you, Amy, for your email, and thank you all who write into the show. It is greatly appreciated. We'll see you next week. The return of Maren Hinkle. I'm very excited for that. She and I will break down Season 3, Episode 2. Until then, I'll see you in my dreams. Please be kind to each other. That's all I ask.
Okay, closing credits time. My Mrs. Maisel Pod was created by me, your host, Kevin Pollack, research writer, producer, Jamie Fox, and our engineer, recording, post-production producer genius is Ken Plume. My Mrs. Maisel Pod is brought to you by the fine folks at Q-Code. Q-Code. Sounds like something, doesn't it? Oh, lastly, you should know, I'm told by legal to make this crystal clear, that my Mrs. Maisel Pod was not sanctioned in any way, shape, or form by Amazon Prime, nor the show's creators Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, although I feel the need to mention I did get their blessing. Okay, good. That should save me some legal fees.
Everyone needs a break from the real world. That's why we played games as kids, and that's why we should play games as adults. I'm Troy LaValle.
And I'm Joe O'Brien. And back in 2015, we started a podcast called The Glass Cannon Podcast, a show made up of comedians and actors playing a fantasy role-playing game.
And now is the perfect time to start listening because we just started a brand new story.
It's basically Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones meets X-Files.
Search for The Glass Cannon Podcast on your podcast app of choice. Hey, life is hard, so come play pretend with us.